It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Rivers are the highways of the North. That's been true since human beings first arrived in North America, and it's still true across a vast expanse of Alaska and Canada that is practical to cross in the summer by no other means. Floating these long, remote rivers opens up some of the world's most beautiful country, and the journeys can also be routes into solitude and your own mind as the banks slide quietly by. On today's show, we're talking about the epic float trips that are possible on our northern rivers, primarily by canoe, and while not everyone is ready to cross the Arctic on a many-week journey, we'll talk about some of the easier floats as well as the most challenging ones. For our first section on the show today, we're going to be talking, and for the whole show, we're going to be talking about floating Arctic and remote rivers. We've talked a bit on the show in the past about, you know, taking your family out to Nancy Lake and that kind of thing, but today we're talking about those really remote adventurous trips, and I've got two guys in the studio who've done a lot of them. Zach Fields, who is writes a headlamp column at the Anchorage Press and is pretty well known around town, and Kurt Gellerman, who has recently retired and has done a lot of floating. And we started talking about canoeing, but it's not going to just be canoeing, right, Zach? I mean, we're going to talk about all kinds of ways to float down a river.
There's a perfect craft for every river.
Yeah, yeah. And Kurt, I mean, tell me, you've been at this for a while. I mean, how did you get introduced to Alaskan float trips?
I look at Alaska, I look at the North, I look at Canada and Alaska. We're different countries, but the rivers kind of go across borders, so one leads into the other.
Yeah.
One of the trips that Zach and I did not that long ago started out in the Yukon, and we've floated into Alaska on the Porcupine River.
Oh, yeah.
That was a real good trip.
And, I mean, let's talk just about why these trips are special. I mean, in a way, it's obvious, but just to start talking about it, get people inspired. I mean, number one, you can go a really, really long way, right?
Correct. Hundreds of miles.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, what's the longest float trip you guys have done?
600 miles.
Wow.
Yeah, 450.
Zach? Yeah. So tell me about that 600-mile trip, Kurt.
That was the Coppermine River up in the Northwest Territories. So we started, it was my wife and I, we started at a place called Winter Lake, which is big and historic. Back in Franklin's day, that was one of his camps. And then we portaged into the Coppermine River and then took the Coppermine River all the way north to the Arctic Ocean.
How long did it take you to do that?
5 weeks. It was great.
Yeah, so 5 weeks basically of no human contact.
Correct.
And just floating along.
Yeah. Wow.
And what did you, what kind of craft did you use for that?
Those were canoes. That was a long time ago, that trip, and we were using Grumman aluminum canoes, 17-foot canoes.
Wow. Two of them, one each?
No, we paddled them tandem.
Other people with you?
Yes. Yeah, we had four canoes, so we had eight people in our party doing that.
Uh-huh. Now, if you're on a trip of that length, and that's a pretty slow-moving river, or is it fast?
The portions that are river, it's fairly fast.
Okay.
But there's lots of lake on that trip. So there's one lake on it that's 100 miles long.
Wow.
It took us a week to get past that lake.
A lot of paddling. Tired arms.
Yeah, and you also have to be kind of tuned into nature. If it's windy during the daytime, you don't paddle during the daytime. You start paddling at night when the wind isn't as much.
And how long ago did you do that trip?
Oh, that was back in 1980.
Okay. Things were a bit different in those days in terms of communication. Once you're out there, you're out there.
Exactly. Yeah. Now we have sat phones and InReach and all different kinds of communication.
Uh-huh. I have this feeling sometimes of looking at the map of Alaska and also of, you know, Canada, I guess, and just seeing, you just start dreaming, right? I mean, it all looks like dreams. I mean, Zach, do you do that? Do you like wintertime sort of look?
That's how every trip starts, I think, is you look at a map and pick the most remote area and sort of see the river that goes through it, which is generally the best way to see a lot of country.
Uh-huh. Tell me about your longest float trip.
Well, our longest float trip was actually very easy on the Yukon River from Whitehorse to Dawson City, which is somewhere in the vicinity of 450 miles.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, beginning canoeist can do that trip. That was my girlfriend and my first trip in the North. And it was a great introduction. And then you can, you know, go do harder rivers. The Yukon is a neat river in the sense that it is kind of remote. It's certainly remote by lower 48 standards, but it has this neat mix of wildlife and history and remote landscapes that is really kind of incomparable when you think about the Yukon's role in the settlement and development of the North. And you can see a lot of that from the riverside, old cabins, trails, places where folks tried to blow out rapids to bring in mining materials. There's a lot of human history as well as the sort of natural landscapes that a lot of people want to explore.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about that today because obviously a lot of our listeners have never done anything like this. And it's really probably maybe the easiest way to get really out into the deep wilderness. You know, you don't have to carry stuff on your back. You don't have to be super skilled if you're on a slow river. You kind of need to be safe. You need to know a bit what you're doing. And then, you know, we always want to get into sort of the gnarly, challenging, and crazy stuff as well. But how did you get started on this? So let's start with you, Zach. I mean, how did you get into like floating remote areas? Did you sort of start in summer camp and something or something, and then just
Grew up paddling, and you know, you kind of want to go to the most interesting area, which is usually the most remote, and that's going to depend on what community you're in. You know, maybe in some communities it's a 5 mile stretch without a house is going to be remote, and then some places, you know, it's 500 miles. And
where did you grow up?
I grew up in Virginia, and a lot of good paddling in Virginia.
Yeah, people here like sort of discount the Southeast, but there's tons of great river floating down there.
Well, and you know, one of the things, I love pack rafts. I probably pack raft more than doing any other kind of paddling, but there's a great place for canoes, especially in wilderness traveling. Kurt and I first paddled together on the East Coast on whitewater, harder whitewater than I would probably do on a remote wilderness trip. But canoes are great because you develop those skills, and then, you know, you can't really go on a 5 week trip. Maybe some people could. It's very hard to pack 5 weeks of gear on a pack raft.
Right.
You can put 5 weeks of gear in a canoe, and unlike a raft, you can paddle across lakes. You can portage it. It's very transportable. It gives you incredible access to some of the most remote places on Earth.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me about how you got into this sport, Kurt.
Well, it was probably when I was a kid, just being in Boy Scouts and being interested with fishing. My father got me started with fishing, so he'd take me to rivers and we'd go fish together. But it probably really didn't blossom until I was in college. I became the head of the outdoor program at our college in New Jersey, and it took off from there. I just wanted to start doing more wilderness trips during college time.
So our Alaskan listeners are going to be like, we're listening to a guy from New Jersey tell us about the outdoors. but it sounds like you lived in New Jersey for a long time, but you've taken off and gone to some pretty remote places over the years.
Yes. Yeah, for the last 40 years.
Uh-huh.
It's my main hobby. I like to collect rivers, doing different rivers all over it, not just Canada, Alaska, even in the southern, the 48 states. There's some great trips to do, both out west and the southeast, down in Florida. There's always places that you can find.
Yeah.
Okefenokee Swamp, we were talking about that earlier on a trip, in the Everglades down in Florida. Texas, you could do the Rio Grande. A lot of nice trips to do.
Yeah. It's true. Almost anywhere you go in the country, there's some opportunity to go canoeing. Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and today we're talking about Arctic and remote canoe trips. And pack rafting and whatever will float you down the river. And my two guests are Zach Fields and Kurt Gellerman, who've done quite a bit of this. So I want to talk a little bit more just about the magic of why it is so, it's hard to express the feeling of floating down a river and not seeing anybody for a long time and just seeing that river bank go by. And it's almost like a metaphor for life, right? You know, when you see the river bank pass by, and it's really hard to remember what passed after you, and you're sort of looking ahead, and what's right there is just what's right there. I don't know. Tell me, why do you like to do this so much, Zach?
I don't think anyone in human history has really described why we do it, and, you know, people keep doing it, so there must be something about it, and probably the English language is not really equipped to describe why we do it. But for me, it's time. The longer you're out there, you get into different rhythms. You start to see different things that you don't see when you're accustomed to city life. And that's what's so great about remote wilderness paddling is, you know, that's something that you can experience whether you're a very experienced whitewater boater or whether you're floating down, you know, a relatively easy river like the Yukon. Either way, you're going to start to and are a different pattern of living. And, you know, there's a huge difference between doing a day hike and going on a 3-day trip. There's sort of another order of magnitude difference in your immersion in the wilderness experience when you're on a 2 or 3 week trip. Or, you know, Kurt and I did it was about a month long trip a few years ago. And, you know, at that point, it's kind of hard to describe, but it's a very different experience living in a remote landscape for that long.
Yeah, I can really identify with that. I haven't done super long float trips, but I've done, 3 week camping trips on my boat out in Prince William Sound. And in the sort of the whole world of time and even how you think changes, right? Because there's no constant interruptions. There's no like interaction. There's no tasks that you have to deal with that are sort of short duration. Everything is sort of flowing together. And, you know, it's the sun rising and setting. It's sort of like clouds floating by. That's what's sort of setting your tempo, right?
And that's so one of the first things you notice is, yeah, 100% of your activity is driven by, solar pattern. We were on the Aniakchak River last week, and everything we did was according to the sun schedule, which, you know, in the summer Alaska is a weird schedule.
Yeah, yeah. Or if you're, yeah, totally. And so you start to find that your brain functions differently. And that's what I think people who haven't been out for long enough might not even have ever experienced that, or it might be a really rare experience. Do you know what I'm talking about, Kurt?
Oh, yes. I mean, there's a good part about wilderness camping is actually sometimes just getting away from the fire. The fire that you're using a lot of times for cooking purposes, but once you get away from that fire and just everything drops off to nature. So you're listening to the pure sounds, you're seeing things without any light pollution. And those are some of the things I just look to see, whether it's the morning sky or the evening sky. It's just great to see that.
Yeah.
I think about time a lot, kind of the magnitude of what's around us. You know, when you look at game trails and think about how long game have been walking in those paths, you know, northern trips, you can see these webs of caribou paths from, you know, caribou herds that are tens of thousands strong that have been walking those same paths for probably millennia. It kind of gives you a sense of perspective that's very hard to get in a city.
Yeah. Well, we had some folks talking about Tango Lakes area on the show recently, and sort of this, you know, there's all this archaeological stuff there, and I asked the archaeologist why, and he said, well, same reason we're there, right? Because that's where the caribou are going through, that's where the rivers are, that's sort of like these natural passageways through the mountains, you know, make these the places where people would travel. So it's not like we're discovering it for the first time. There have been people there for millennia, but it hasn't been changed too much. And I think what you said, Kurt, is a really good one about getting away from the fire. You know, there's a sense of, you know, driving the Dalton Highway or driving our rural highways in Alaska that you're really out there, but there's that human thread that goes through it that kind of orients you. And then once you're completely away from that, you have to sort of take it in a whole new way, right? And one thing about rivers is, and you guys may have a different perception, but to me, the process is creating that landscape. And so it's really hard for me to remember a particular bend in the river. They all kind of meld together in a way, and you kind of have to take them sort of a process-oriented way of thinking rather than a sort of linear way we'd think of, like a landscape, this is here, that's there. And that's really important when you're paddling, to understand those processes and how they change the landscape.
It's kind of hard to get out of your normal thought patterns, but one of the amazing things about some of these remote rivers, you know, the Tashinsheni-Alsek, is that they're so immense and so spectacular that they force you out of your normal mindset and force you to think about, like, gosh, it's impossible to conceive of something like this without actually seeing it. And, you know, that's probably a healthy thing for people to do from time to time.
Without doubt, yeah. I bet you've seen some incredible stuff on your trips, Kurt. I mean, what are some of the most spectacular floats you've been on?
There was a trip up in Baffin Island, and we did a river called the Soper River. And actually, in my 40 years of boating and going down rivers, this was the first time we had to use an outfitter because we couldn't figure out any other way to get a canoe up on Baffin Island. But the outfitters had the canoes, but they wouldn't rent the canoes directly to us. And I can understand that because of insurance purposes. But so we went with an outfitter. There were just fantastic things that we were seeing on this trip in the Soper. Wolves kind of encircling a bunch of caribou.
Wow.
And then watching the whole thing play out where the wolves were just circling around the caribou very slowly. And the caribou picked up on it, saw the opening, and took off. And all the caribou got away. And we were watching this from a ridgeline, so we watched the whole thing.
Wow.
It was amazing.
Yeah. Do you want to jump in, Zach, with some amazing memories or stuff that you've seen on trips?
Well, we were paddling on the Eagle River up in the Yukon Territories a few years ago, a small river tributary of the Yukon, and paddling along, and there was a moose in the middle of the river, which shallow river, 6 inches deep. It was like, why is this moose out here? It's bizarre. Just two canoes paddling up to it. It wasn't moving. So, you know, we just slowed down, couldn't really go backwards. And eventually the moose turned. It was like 15 feet away and ran straight at us in the river.
Wow.
So we were like, you know, did the typically stupid thing of scattering like squirrels, and the moose ran right between the two canoes, like 5 feet away, charging moose. It's like, God, this animal's crazy. But, you know, then we looked down the shore and there were these two wolves on the bank, and the moose was actually using us to get shed of the wolves and ran across the other side of the bank, ran away. And, you know, it's incredible to think about, well, gosh, we were just in this one very small place in an immense wilderness, and this is happening. So what else is happening 100 yards away that we're not seeing?
Right.
And then it's kind of incredible to think about this moose, you know, being so so adaptive to a situation that, I mean, how many times did a canoe go down the river that year? Once.
Yeah.
And it happened to that moose, and he used it to escape the wolves.
Wow. Yeah, but by the fact that you're out there so long, you create the sort of probability you're going to run into something like that, right? I mean, if you're just out on day hike, you know, the chances are pretty low because you're probably close to town, and also just the amount of time you're out is not enough. So, you know, these long float trips, like there's many different, yeah. So let's talk a little bit about different routes in Alaska. I know that there are some that are particularly, you know, sort of Arctic and remote routes. And I guess there's probably categorize them as ones that you could do. I mean, obviously, you guys are experts. You could do any of them yourself. But, I mean, some of them, somebody who's not an expert could do without a guide, and others, you really do need a guide. And maybe it's maybe we start with some trips that are gentler. You mentioned the Yukon as being a good starting point. I've heard the Noatak River referred to as sort of a good sort of beginner's river. Have you guys done that one?
I haven't been on the Noatak.
No, I have not.
Too easy, huh?
Well, it's actually it's pretty remote. It's an easier river to canoe, but it's difficult to get to, and you have to spend some money just to get there.
Yeah,
and that's one of the things I always think about is kind of the like remoteness to cost balance, and there are a lot of remote places you can get pretty affordably, but that makes it harder to go to an equally remote area that's three times as expensive.
All right, well, let's talk about that. I mean, I guess the way you do Noatak is fly to Kotzebue and take a plane out and drop into one of the villages and float to another village and fly out. So give us one that that you think has a really good remoteness to cost ratio. I mean, you're gonna have to share some of your deep dark secrets here. You've already agreed to come on the radio.
Well,
so.
we canoed and rafted the Copper River a few years ago, and the Copper's not an Arctic river. It flows into the Gulf of Alaska near Cordova. But the Copper River is very remote. The scenery is unbelievable.
Spectacular.
You know, dropping in from kind of almost an interior ecosystem through the coastal mountains. It's choked with glaciers, incredible wildlife. And, you know, you put in a McCarthy, you can drive.
Right.
And then when you take out in Cordova, you get on the Marine Ferry. It's one of the cheapest.
After like 10 days, 2 weeks.
Yeah, 10 days is a great length of time. The Copper
but
is an amazing
trip.
But
that would be for somebody who's got some fairly advanced skills, right?
Well, not really. I mean, if you're rafting it, there's, you know, the whitewater is very easy.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have access to a raft and, you know, a little bit of rowing experience, if you know how to be outside in the wilderness, then that's a good trip for people. Yeah, mentioned the Yukon.
And there's also a bunch of companies that will do that. I mean, if you're...
Sure.
I guess I feel like if you've never done a remote trip like this, it's probably good to go with somebody first.
Every one
who knows
of these,
how to
you,
do
can,
it.
You yeah. can do a guided trip.
Yeah.
Which is... I mean, I've never done that just because it's so expensive.
Right.
But yeah, guided trips are always available. A good self-guided trip, you know, we mentioned earlier is the Yukon. You can canoe from Whitehorse to Dawson City. You show up in Whitehorse, you rent a canoe, you float down to Dawson, you leave the canoe on the riverbank, you fly home. It's pretty cheap. You can get out in a huge landscape.
Yeah, I think people do that from Circle down to the highway as well.
And then, yeah, people
can drive this East Highway to Circle and then float down to the Dalton Highway or even go to Eagle, although I guess that would be quite a fairly long float to go down from Eagle.
Yeah, Eagle to Circle, I think people do that in. Mm-hmm. Usually take about a week.
You have to preposition a vehicle on a long, long drive on
the long
road.
Shuttle.
Yeah.
Well, another interesting trip would be the Stikine, where you start in Canada and you can come out in Alaska near Wrangell. It's a nice river to float on. Good fishing, good camping. The scenery's excellent. And then you get the bonus, there's hot springs in the middle of the trip. And it's amazing. The Forest Service has put in these beautiful facilities that you can be in the middle of the wilderness and have a hot spring like that.
And where would you rank that one in terms of how challenging or difficult?
Easy.
It's easy trip.
Yeah, it's class one paddling. And we canoed it, and we actually brought pack rafts to do side trips, which was really fun. Mm-hmm. But, you know, canoes, someone who's comfortable on class two could easily do this class one wilderness trip. Very affordable, relatively accessible.
So how did you get up the river? Did you take a boat from Wrangell?
Or? You can take a jet boat to do your shuttle, jet boat up the river. Or if you take a folding canoe, then you could potentially put in Canada, float out to Wrangell, get on the plane, and go home.
And fly.
Yeah.
From Wrangell.
Right. And so the Forest Service keeps cabins, and there's what is it called? There's a hot springs partway along there where you can bathe and stuff. Chief
Shakes,
right.
Chief Shakes.
And there's I've heard the scenery there is just extraordinary, huh?
It's unbelievable, and it's a little surprising to me that more people don't do the Stikine. You know, if you read John Muir's Alaska writing, which is some of the best sort of wilderness writing about Alaska, Muir went to the Stikine and wrote about the Shakes Glacier, the Great Glacier, some of the mountains around there, and, you know, the depth of the canyons that now are being left behind by the glaciers, the remnant glaciers, the glaciers that are still up on the Stikine ice field. It's an incredible thing to see from the river. And it's also a neat place to visit because you're on a river with large cottonwoods, kind of a verdant, comfortable environment, but not too high up is this huge ice field.
Yeah. Yeah, and Wrangell's kind of a neat town, too. I mean, you do have to get to Wrangell somehow, so you've got a plane ticket involved here. None of these are totally cheap, but we'll get into more of those details of how to set up a trip in the second half. But let's go around the state some more and long float trips that folks could do who are not super advanced in their skills and that are, you know, more accessible. Any other ideas to throw out? Or even in Canada, too. I mean, I think most of us, often we don't even think about Canada. It's sort of out of mind, but it sounds like you've done a lot of trips in Canada, Kurt.
Right. Other easy trips to get on and get off. That's the challenging thing is to have a map in front of you to take a look at those places where you can get in and get off. Road access is generally the cheaper way to access a river.
Mm-hmm.
You need a put-in and you need a take-out. And figuring out exactly what you want the trip to be works within those that put-in and take-out. And there's a number of trips that you can do. You could pick them off in the Yukon. You can do it even in Northwest Territories. There are trips that you can that run along the roadway, but yet the road goes away from the river oftentimes, so you feel like you're really in a remote area when the road's really not that far away.
The whole Yukon Basin, you know, the Teslin, the Pelly, the Big Salmon River. I think people go there for the remoteness. Most of those are fairly easy rivers, but they do have a remote quality to them.
Where do you get information about a river? I mean, I suppose you guys just look at a map and call up your buddies and ask, but I mean, there's got to be places where you can find information about rivers that, you know, just, I know there's some books out there, but I mean, what do you do when you're trying to scope out, figure out if you want to do a trip?
Going to the books is a good source. There's always usually good writing available. Alaska's got some great books on rivers that you can look up the river that you're interested in. Canada also has some of those books, not as much writing, but you can also contact the government. If you're a beginner and you want to start out contacting, say, the Yukon government, ask them about rivers, ask them about put-ins and takeouts. Government's a good source of information.
There are a few guidebooks I would recommend. Fast and Cold by Andrew Embeck is kind of the classic guidebook to Alaska paddling. Karen Jetmar has a really good book.
It's Alaska River Guide, I think it's called.
I think it's the Alaska River Guide, and that's kind of more geared toward these remote wilderness trips. MBIX is kind of half whitewater, half remote trips. And then there's actually an outstanding whitewater guide for the Yukon territories in BC, which I've only seen sold in Max Fireweed books and Whitehorse. but you could call Max and order that book, and it has just about every mile of navigable water in the Yukon and BC as far as long trips, and it's an outstanding guidebook. And I've actually never seen that information for those Yukon and BC rivers on the internet,
which is interesting.
Yeah, it's surprising. So anyway, if you're going to the Yukon, really, you should call Max Fireweed Books and ask him for the best guidebook
on
those rivers.
Which is in where?
It's in Whitehorse.
Okay. So I'm going to try to remember to get all that put up on the website so people can get some of these book recommendations, MBIX and Jet Mars. And this last one was that you just mentioned.
Oh, so it's a Yukon River Guidebook. And I don't remember the title of it, but it's available from Max.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in terms of Alaska trips, I think if you're just thinking like, gosh, where could I go? You know, Roman Dial's blog and Luke Mell's blog are a place a lot of people start for inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll get those linked on our website too. So if you want to find out more information, just go to alaskapublic.org and take a look at today's show, which we're calling Arctic Canoe Trips, although we're not excluding rafts and pack rafts and any other logs, you know, whatever you can float down the river in. And in the second half of the show, I want to talk more about some of the more extreme and challenging trips that can be done, and then also how to set up a trip and how to be safe and what kinds of things to consider about gear, communication, boats, and all that, with my two guests, Zach Fields and Kurt Gellerman. So stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Right now, we're going to take a journey into the APRN archives. Reporter John Ryan, now at KUCB in Unalaska, floated an epic trip in southeast Alaska. It's called the Ausek Tatsashini. Here's his story.
The sun shines on a small clearing in the aspens and spruce along the Tatsashini River near the southwest corner of the Yukon Territory. Outfitters Kate and Stan Bohr of Haines are helping our small group get two inflatable rafts ready for 10 days of no turning back travel. From here, the Tatsashini flows into the Ausek River. The Ausek punches through the world's tallest coastal mountains to enter the Gulf of Alaska. Mostly, the Bohrs are teaching us the meticulous art of securing hundreds of pounds of food and gear onto the rafts.
Especially for the canyon, we want to strap these into place for these boxes to keep them from moving around. And again, we're going to have bags on top of this too. You can use a blue one there and just feed it
on each raft. We build a waterproof jigsaw puzzle of dry bags, ammunition cans, coolers, and buckets. Then comes Stan's safety talk on the 140 miles of what he calls extreme wilderness that we're about to travel. Hypothermia, icebergs, capsizes, grizzlies.
And maybe the only other thing is the fluctuating river. It has a tendency to go way up and way down in a short amount of time at any time of day. So make sure you have your boats well tied up.
The midday sky turns dark and fat raindrops start to pelt us. Bohr warns us that we'll enter a canyon and the worst rapids of the 10-day trip just about a half hour after we start.
Your biggest nemesis are canyon walls, and you'll see as soon as you enter it, it's really sharp rocks. You just really can't hit the walls or you risk putting a hole in your boat. And that changes the whole complexion of the day.
Except when it's flooding, the Tat is not an especially fierce river. It's fabled among river rafters because of its scenery and wildness, not the whitewater thrills. Our party of four Juneau residents and one friend from Seattle sets off. Two of us have rafted the Tot before. Four of us are wearing dry suits, and we've all got life vests on. The river decides not to rise anymore that day, and we manage to make our way through the rapids unscathed. At the Shawshe Meadows put-in point, the Tatshenshini is a modest-sized river, less than 100 yards wide. The jade-green waters give no hint of the radically different river just a few days' float away. Where the landscape isn't vegetated, it feels raw and naked. So new, it hasn't found its angle of repose. Boulders and gravel tumble without warning. Raw glacial creeks pour into the Tot, invisible boulders clacking downstream in the muddy current. Each creek adds to the river's flow, and the Tot keeps growing. 3 days in, it's half a mile wide. You can travel for days at a time here without seeing any signs of human activity, let alone any other people. But we happened to overtake a group of rafters from Idaho. Freelance photographer and avid river rafter Glenn Oakley of Boise says down south, there's nothing like the Alsek in either size or speed.
At one point, we were going 14 miles an hour in a raft. That's fast. That's ripping. And when stuff's coming at you, when you've got to make decisions way in advance, because otherwise you're going to end up in a place you may not want to be.
About 80 miles into the trip, we float across the invisible border back into Alaska. The Alsek is now 2 miles wide. It feels more like an ocean than a river. At one point, you can see 24 glaciers in every direction. The mind boggles to comprehend the scale. River runners here call it sensory overload syndrome. On a river this wide and fast, we know we have to pick our route far upstream to get to shore at any particular spot.
On most whitewater trips, you pull over and hike downstream a bit to scout any big rapids. But on the Alsek, you scout for icebergs. We've pulled over near the end of a peninsula that juts out into the entrance to Alsek Lake, which is covered in icebergs, and we're scouting down to see if there's a pass through that won't be choked with icebergs. The narrow passage through the lake is called the Channel of Death, so we're going to check it out to see if it's passable or whether we're going to have a long portage.
Trip organizer Julie Scheuer of Juneau sees an unwelcome, if not unexpected, sight in the lake.
Yeah, all the ice smashed against the knob. It's not just smashed up against it, it's like piled up on it.
Unfortunately, we also get our first glimpse of our potential portage around the lake. Through the binoculars, it appears an apartment building-sized iceberg is blocking our plan B out of here. So we hike to the end of a peninsula for a better vantage. Kevin Hood of Juneau thinks there might be a passage through the icebergs that we can't quite see.
There may still be a way. This is a huge volume of water going, and it's just hard from this slanted perspective.
But it's like a maze.
I'm not willing
to get stuck in the middle of a bunch of icebergs.
Dissension in the ranks, so we hike to a small hilltop for another perspective. We see that apartment building of ice isn't actually blocking our back channel portage. So instead of pushing our luck with the towers and slabs of ancient ice in the Channel of Death, we decide to push the rafts overland. We get back in the rafts and head to the mostly dry river channel that bypasses the iciest parts of Alsek Lake. We unload the rafts and scour the riverbanks for long, smooth pieces of driftwood. They'll work as primitive rollers to get the heavy rafts across a quarter-mile portage. Now it's time to earn our safety
One,
with some hard labor.
Two, three.
Two hours later, we've got all the gear back in the boats. We row around the corner to the last campsite of our 10-day trip and a well-earned rest. We sit by the fire, look out toward the forked tongue of the Alsek Glacier, listen to icebergs rumble and crack, and savor the adventure stories we'll have to tell later on. For AK, I'm John Ryan on the Alsek River.
We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and we're talking today about Arctic canoe trips and floating long rivers. We talked on the show in the past about taking your family out to Nancy Lake or the Swan Lake canoe routes. That's a good place to get started and learn your craft for sure. But I've got a couple of guests in the studio today who have done some really challenging trips and have been over you know, long rivers and whitewater and have done some of the more adventurous parts of this sport. And we talked in the first half a little bit about why you do that and the sort of the magic of wilderness immersion and becoming part of these incredible places. And I want to learn some more in this half about the places these guys have been that most people haven't and some of the challenges and ventures they faced. And then also how to put together a trip in terms of gear and in terms of safety and in terms of, you know, who's in your team and all that. I guess, you know, I restrained you guys to talking about trips on easy rivers to start out with, but when I hear people talking about their trips, it's always much more about bragging about the difficult, the challenging, and rapids are classed. It's one through five, right? So one is like smooth river, and five is like impossible, more or less.
And then there's a six class that you don't want to be on. You
can kind of like unpaddleable. But yeah, as far as stuff that you would paddle, it's one through five.
Oh, I got you. So six is like you've gone over a waterfall.
All this stuff is subjective, but yeah.
Really nice to look at. You don't want to be on their boat.
So what kind of first of all, it's something I've always wondered about this classification system. Is it seems like one through five would kind of depend on how much water is in the river and how fast it's flowing. That changes through the year and it changes by the weather. And so you can be in a river that is classed higher and then you're in it and you're kind of picking up your canoe and dragging it half the time. Or you can be in a river that's classed as being easy and you find out it's not easy. So, I mean, Zach, what is your, how does this classification system work in terms of that issue?
Well, you know, a river could be rated at a certain difficulty level, and typically they're rated at certain difficulty levels based on the amount of water in the river at a given time. So, you know, 6 Mile Canyon, a local creek, the first canyon might be class 3+ at 10 feet, and it would absolutely be class 4 at 11 feet. And every river is like that. It changes a lot with difficulty.
When you use those feet, you're talking about
like, that's just on a gauge. So a lot of these remote trips, you're dealing with a river that has no gauge.
Right.
And you really got to be tuned in to the typical runoff in a given landscape and watershed based on the season. You know, most of these rivers, if they're in an area with a significant snowpack, you're going to have higher water in June. You're going to have a low water period after breakup, maybe late May, early June. Then you're going to have a surge as the snow melts. And then the flow volume is going to taper off. And it's really going to taper off in sometime, maybe in September, October, when it gets cold and the glacier melt subsides. But you want to look at that balance of, is this primarily glacier fed? Is it primarily snow melt? Is it primarily spring fed? And think about, you know, when you're planning your trip, you're trying to aim for the most likely scenario of the right water level. And that's going to vary a lot by river. And you're right, it can change the difficulty dramatically. And sometimes lower water can be a little bit harder if you're on a more technical river, but in general, higher water is going to be harder.
Seems like a lot of local knowledge is what you're talking about. I mean, if it's a really remote area, that information you'd kind of be guessing a little bit, right?
I think there are always people who are going to know that stuff. And the great thing about being Alaska, where so many people do really ambitious trips, is that you can pretty much always ask someone, and you're going to get a very precise answer.
How do you network? I mean, other than just the fact that you know a lot of people.
Yeah, and I would say I'm not, you know, particularly more connected than anyone else. You know, I mentioned Roman Dial, Luke Mell, Brad Meckeljohner have explored a lot of rivers around here, and, you know, I think they'll help anyone plan a trip if you have questions.
Yeah, go to their blogs and stuff.
What about or post on, there's a forum called packrafting.org. Obviously, it's geared toward packrafting and has a lot of remote rivers on there, and if you post on there, lots of people will come to your assistance. Mm-hmm.
So what about up in Canada? I mean, I think of those Northwest Territory, Yukon rivers being, in a way, even more remote than Alaska because there's less people in that part of the world. Is when you are looking for local knowledge about a river, do you sort of check out and find out what people have to say in the area, or do you kind of just use your gut?
Yeah, I think you use more your gut on those because you don't have the water gauges on those rivers, those remote rivers, like you would probably on a lot of local rivers here in Alaska. But the same thing is on the North Slope here in Alaska. You don't generally have river gauges, but you do have people who have run those rivers it's difficult to come across people that on the remote rivers in Canada that have actually done some of these rivers. So it's tough to track them down.
Yeah. And one way is, you know, call the guide service. There's a outfit in Alaska called Arctic Wild that guides a lot of trips up in the Arctic Refuge and the North Slope. You know, those guys are really dialed in on those rivers, and they could tell you, hey, based on the snowpack we have this year, here's how that's going to affect the water on the Hula Hula. So, you know, it's always worth calling a guide company and just asking the folks who spend a lot of time on those rivers.
Well, tell me, Kurt, is that part of the sort of attraction of going out and doing a river where, like, you don't even know anybody's done it? You know, probably hardly anybody ever does it, and you're kind of a...
Oh, absolutely. And it is the draw. Part of the thing that attracts me to the sport is just getting into some area that very, very few people have been. And it's interesting to take the situation, and you have to change your plans to suit the situation. So if you have low water, you end up getting out of your canoe and walking the canoe down the river, lining it, whatever you need, portage around a rapid instead of running the rapid.
Because you don't know what it's like, what's on the other side.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I think you can actually do too much research. Like I mentioned, we just were in doing the Aniakchak River, and you know that's a river that's increased in popularity. When we walked
up, where's that located?
That's down on the Alaska Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And when we walked up to the rim of the crater and looked in, you know, I'm really glad I didn't see a photo of that before I went there. Mm. So I would actually encourage people not to do so much research that you feel like you're just walking down the page of a map.
You don't want to kill it off, yeah. You don't want to kill off the adventure. But, Kurt, it sounds like some of these places you've been, like, you really had no idea what you were going to run into. It's kind of like a Powell cross, you know, floating the Colorado a little bit, right?
That's like, true, because, well, I like to specialize in trips where I'm going up and over the height of land. So I'm between two different watersheds, and I have to portage my gear into the river that I'm actually trying to get down. And a lot of times it's a lot of hard work. It's part of the outdoor experience for me that I like to do the hard work to get there.
Well, you add that in, and that pares down the number of people who are going to do it even more, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So tell me about what one of the trips you're most proud of or that fixes in your memory the most in terms of just the remoteness and the adventure.
Oh, long time ago, my wife and... six of our friends decided to do the South Nahanni River, but
and where's that?
The South Nahanni is in the Northwest Territories, right very close to the Yukon border. The South Nahanni flows into the Liard River, and then the Liard flows into the Mackenzie River at Fort Simpson. And we decided early on that we were going to do it a little bit different. So we decided that we were going to portage in off the Canole Road. The Canole Road is famous in the area because it got punched through the woods back in World War II to draw the oil out of Norman Wells.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't really use it much, but the road is there. So we used
that. Is it kind of abandoned, or is it still really functioning?
It's, well, you say kind of abandoned. Yes, it's kind of abandoned, but the government, I think, of the Yukon decides to keep it up as much as possible because they realize that a lot of sports people use that road to access the wilderness in that area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they do some work on it from time to time. But we use that road to access some streams on the Yukon side, and we spent a week portaging into the Nahanni and then spent 4 weeks coming down the Nahanni, and it was just a great trip. And this is before the Nahanni became really popular. Actually, before it was it's now a Canadian park. So there's a waterfall on it that's like twice the height of Niagara Falls. There's hot springs on it. It's just a gorgeous area.
So when you say you spent a week portaging, you're carrying your canoe and all your gear for a week.
Well,
that doesn't sound like fun.
Well, yeah, that part's not fun, but it's part of the experience. And when I say that, it's not carrying the boat the entire time for the week. You're lining up rivers, you're paddling across lakes. So we figured we had about 28 to 30 miles that we had to do. And out of that 28 miles, we probably had to carry our boats, actually, 8 miles of it.
Wow. But it was worth it. I mean, because what you saw and the feeling like nobody else is there.
And you're really getting involved with that whole area immediately. Like, once you get dropped off on the Canole Road and you start in, it's just... it's a good experience. It's a good way to just challenge yourself to get to a river.
Mm-hmm. Did you run into any really challenging paddling on there?
Oh, yeah. There's some great whitewater on the upper stretch of the South Nahanni. And then there's canyons down below the waterfall, Virginia Falls. Beautiful canyons.
I mean, always when I hear about these trips, I think, well, I've got all my gear in the canoe, and I'm hoping to be out here for weeks, and I'm going to go into this whitewater. What if something goes wrong? You know, what if I mess up? And, I mean, you read about, you know, is that when I read about people in the paper? I mean, that's what, really?
Yeah, I mean, you got precautions. I mean,
there's a lot of riding on your being able to navigate that whitewater.
Correct. But then if it's so challenging that you feel that you can't accomplish that whitewater, that's when you get out of your boat. You either portage around or you line your boat down.
So it's judgment and also judgment. Scouting.
Yeah. Being safe, using all the safety that's available. So you definitely should have a life jacket on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk more about that in a minute. But first I want to get Zach, ask him the same question, like a trip that sticks in your memory as being something you really was an adventure and that you really look back on as being one of the best.
Well, my girlfriend and I did a trip in Borneo a few years ago, and I think what I liked about it is that I had no information on the river whatsoever, and it was a river that we walked into, you know, from the top of the watershed and went down to sea level. And there's, like Kurt was saying, you know, getting to know the watershed. It's there's something about following a river from its source to the ocean that really teaches you something about the whole ecosystem. And you know, in Alaska, when you go down to the ocean, it's always amazing, you know, to start out in the Alpine, like in the Aniakchak crater, you know, it's largely cinder dust. There's very little life up in that crater compared to a lot of places that we're used to. You get down to the ocean, you know, it's this profusion of marine life, and it's that whole system is the river system, and I just think there's a lot of value in going from the source to the sea.
Yeah.
Even if that sometimes requires portaging in.
Yeah. Have you done a trip like Kurt's talking about where here in Alaska where you really don't have much information and you're kind of picking your way along?
No. You know, we did a trip a couple years ago that Kurt talked about, the Porcupine River. We were actually trying to go into the Firth watershed from the Old Crow River, which is a route that I don't think anyone maybe has been foolish enough to attempt before or since.
So give us a geography lesson here about where you're talking about.
Yeah, so we started on the Dempster Highway, paddled maybe 200-300 miles downstream to Old Crow.
Right, we're paddling on the Eagle River, the Little Bell River, the Bell River, and then into the Porcupine.
I'm still not like oriented as to where we are.
This is way north Yukon.
Oh, okay.
Just east of the Arctic Refuge on the Yukon Territory side near the Dempster Highway.
Got you.
Other than the Hall Road is the only road that sort of goes north and started at the Dempster. So yeah, from the village of Old Crow, which is, it's a bush village like other bush villages in Alaska, except it's on the Canadian side. We went 176 miles upstream on the Old Crow through hellacious mosquitoes for, I think it took like 9 days to paddle upstream. Mm-hmm. And that trip didn't work out, but you know, when you look at...
That sounds like non-fun, mosquitoes and paddling upstream.
It was type 3 fun. But you got to, you know, that's one of those ones where, yeah, there's a trade-off. You can go to a river where, you know, people have written a lot about it. You know exactly what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. You're going to finish that trip, and that's great. And I think a lot of us do trips like that. And then maybe you go to another trip, and you know a lot less about it. And with those trips, there's a decent chance it might not work out because of water level or difficulty of the rapids, or in the case of this trip that we went on to the Porcupine and the attempting to go to the Firth, it was the portage that was so much different than we anticipated. But that uncertainty is part of the mystique of attempting to do the trip.
And when you say it didn't work out, what do you mean exactly?
The portage was a lot wetter and more difficult than we had anticipated. And
so
we
you
also
had, to turn
had a
around
dynamic
and go back,
of
basically, or
yeah, and mm-hmm. you know, we floated out a different way than we had come in, and it was a great trip. Paddled hundreds more miles through the ramparts of the Porcupine, you know,
all the way down to the Fort Yukon.
Wow.
Yeah, through the southern part of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which is an incredible place. So
yeah, well, I wanted to get into that, and it's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking obviously about Arctic and super remote canoeing around Alaska and Canada. And we got Borneo in there for a minute. and my guests are Zach Fields and Kurt Gellerman. So let's talk about the Arctic Refuge, because that is such like a place of, you know, such a symbol. And a lot of people take trips there because of it's a political issue. Tell me about the floating there. Have you done the refuge, Zach?
Well, when we floated down the Porcupine, we were going through hundreds of miles of the mm-hmm. refuge, including the migration path mm-hmm. of a lot of the caribou. And I think what's the political issues are mostly centered on the what people call the 1002 area up on right. the north slope, a relatively small part of the refuge. I think what the allure of the refuge is a landscape that's big, not just in a geographic sense, but in the sense that it has these huge caribou herds that migrate a really long way.
Yeah.
So it's, you're sort of looking into this relationship, not just with the land, but with some really amazing animals that. Yeah, I mean, how many places on Earth have herds of anything, tens of mm-hmm. thousands strong, crossing millions of acres? You know, it's almost a singular thing on Earth.
But the Porcupine is not the main river that people. It's a Hula Hula, and what's the other one?
There are a lot of little rivers that drain the North Slope, the Yago, the Hula Hula, and yeah, you can. Those are a little more expensive to get to if you fly in. Mm-hmm. Some people walk in, and you can sort of set up food drops and walk in with pack rafts. But we were paddling through the southern portion of the Arctic Refuge,
which is sort of there's the kind of the Brooks Range foothills, and then there's the sort of flat area. And
right.
I don't know. It do you feel like people go there because it's famous, and maybe they should go other places?
I mean, I think people use the designation of a wildlife refuge, and they say, "Oh, well, gosh, if someone designated this a wildlife refuge, it must be really cool."
Mm-hmm.
And it is a cool place, but there are a lot of cool places that aren't designated as wilderness or a wildlife refuge.
Well, this is the thing that when you're up there, there's no line on the ground, right? I mean,
right.
It looks about the same on either side as it does actually in the middle, right? So don't get hung up on designations. Well, let's talk a little bit in the last 10 minutes or so we have about setting up a trip and things to think about and sort of what you need to what you need for gear. And well, communication is always a big one that people talk a lot about. You know, it used to be, as we were talking earlier, that you were fine without any communication, or at least hopefully you were. Now it seems like a lot of people, maybe most people, are carrying satellite phones and other ways of communicating in case they run into trouble. What's your thinking on that, Kurt? What do you carry?
Well, whatever we have available at the time. Some of the trips we do bring sat phones with us. We generally rent those, and the cost has come down considerable over the years on sat phone rental. This last trip that we did down to the crater, we brought a device called an InReach, which allows you to send text messages out using the Iridium satellites, which is they're the same satellites that are used for the satellite phones. And that worked out fine because we were able to communicate back and forth with the bush pilot that we hired for the takeout to get us back to civilization.
Yeah,
what's the advantage of that?
What's that?
The advantage of the InReach with the text messaging, is it just a little
easier? It's lighter and smaller than a sat phone.
Yeah, it seems like with a sat phone, you have to be able to see the sky, and at least when I've used them, they're not always 100% sure you're going to be able to make a call.
I think logistics drive everything. I mean, the trips I go on that don't rely on a bush plane pickup, I typically don't bring communication.
Mm-hmm.
If you're flying out of somewhere, you're going to pay for that bush flight if he flies there and he can't land. So you have to carry a communication device to communicate with the pilot when you're getting picked up.
Or it's going to cost you.
Yeah. And, you know, those are the kind of things that drive decisions. If you're looking at the simplest, kind of smallest device that is, provides you a margin of safety, then, yeah, it's the DeLorme InReach, or, you know, there's a Spot device, which mm-hmm. is basically just, you can hit a little button that says, I'm okay. You know, your friends and family get a little spot on a map. I'm okay. Here's where I am. Or if there's a true emergency, then you can basically hit the, call for a rescue. And if you want to have sort of the security of a plan, you know, Z last ditch emergency, you can carry that kind of emergency locator beacon without sort of communicating in the same degree that you would with a mm-hmm. sat phone or even the texting, which personally I don't want to communicate with the outside world when I'm in the wilderness.
Yeah, it does. It takes away from it a bit. Yeah, for sure. Especially if it's casual communication. How do you pack your gear? What kind of containers do you put your gear in?
On river trips, you try and waterproof your gear off. So you've got sleeping bags, you've got tents, you've got clothes that you need to bring, and then you've got your food that you're bringing in with you. because living off the land is not something that I would suggest to
yeah.
do. You could try to do that, but it's not easy. And then a lot of times,
and it's not easy on the land either.
Exactly. So you want waterproof bags, and in the old days, plastic bags worked fine, but you didn't use the normal kitchen-type garbage bag, which are very thin bags. Mm-hmm. You'd use more industrial plastic compactor bags. So
the trash compactor bags are pretty tough.
Yep. Or three mil mm-hmm. thickness.
The contractor bags.
Yep.
What kind of canoe do you use, eh?
Well, in town, we've got a 17-foot Old Town Tripper, which is kind of the perfect wilderness exploration boat. And then we've got a...
What's it made of?
It's a Royal X type of plastic.
Mm-hmm. And what makes that an appealing canoe?
Well, the Tripper has a lot of capacity. You can carry gear for like a 5-week trip, like Kurt was talking about. It's got a little bit of rocker. Rocker is the amount of curvature along the length of the canoe. Basically, more rocker means more maneuverability. However, there's a trade-off, because if you have too much rocker, it's very hard to paddle in a straight line across a lake or on flat water. So the Tripper mm-hmm. is kind of the perfect balance. It's very stable.
Mm-hmm. And you were going to mention another canoe?
Well, we also have a smaller whitewater canoe that I wouldn't really recommend for wilderness travel.
Uh-huh.
I think everything in terms of packing is driven by the river and the trip and what kind of portage, if any, you're gonna do into that river. You know, if it's a long portage, you're probably going to carry a pack raft, and everything is going to fit in your backpack. And
right.
when you get there, you're going to put your pack raft on the pack raft and paddle down. If you're doing a canoe trip that has a long portage, you're going to want to be able to do that portage in as small a number of carries as possible
mm-hmm.
and have your gear as packable as possible. If you're doing the Yukon River, where you're putting it on the river and taking out on the river, you don't need to worry about portaging.
Right.
And it's all driven by the nature of the trip in the river.
And if you have to get in a float plane, then it's a whole additional. You know,
yeah, and float planes, a lot of the time, like this trip we were on the Aniakchak, you know, pack rafts are by far the most practical because mm-hmm. you can walk in, and you can either walk out or you can fly out, and pack rafts just make a lot of sense yeah. for those kind of trips.
Well, there's a lot for people to learn. You know, get started on Goose Lake and work your way up to what these guys are doing. I really want to thank both of you guys for being in here. It's been really interesting and very inspiring to get out there and do some of this stuff. My guests have been Zach Fields. Thanks for being with us, Zach.
Thanks, Charles.
And Zach writes the headlamp column for Anchorage Press. And Kurt Gellerman, who is a New Jerseyan who's showing up all us tough Alaskans who think because of some of the stuff he's done is amazing. Thanks for being with us, Kurt.
Okay.
Please join us again next week at the same time for another edition of Outdoor Explorer. You can always find out what we've got coming up on the show by checking our website. Go to alaskapublic.org and click on the Outdoor Explorer icon. Many thanks to our producer, Monica Gokey, and to Grace Bojean, who books many of our guests. I'm Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.